grabs her backpack, hops a jet plane, heads to France, grows a garden, writes a screenplay, and she's learning how to dance. And all the possibilities of her imagination are turning into her reality. And Virginia looks up, she says. Early morning, fog is lifting, she's in a rowboat on a lake. She is dreaming, she is drifting, never been so wide awake. Captured in the moment by the beauty all around her, there's nowhere else that she would rather be. And Virginia looks up, she says, this could be my day. And she thinks a thought of thanks for all the things that come her way. And some say she's a dreamer, and some call her a fool. But before you even blink your eyes, Virginia saves her money, grabs her backpack, hops a jet plane, heads to France, grows a garden, writes a screenplay, and she's learning how to dance. And all the possibilities of her imagination are turning into her reality. And Virginia looks up, she says, this could be my day. And she thinks a thought of thanks for all the things that come her way. And some say she's a dreamer, and some call her a fool. But before you even blink your eyes, Virginia says, I didn't come here to worry or wonder, hide away under the ground. The heartbeat I hear makes it perfectly clear that I'm here to live out loud.
Hello, you are listening to KDRT LP 95.7 FM. This is Karen Motokaitis, host of How She Really Does It, where inspiration and possibility meet. I continue my search for answers to improve our lives from people who have spent their lives learning, growing, and understanding. And on How She Really Does It, we bring guests on the show to really dive into issues to help inform, inspire, and empower you towards a better life. Love to hear your listeners' comments about our shows or questions for upcoming guests. You can email us by going to our website, www.howshereallydoesit.com, and to send me an email, or you can find our Facebook and Twitter links also on there, along with our newsletter subscriber, where we offer special incentives for our newsletter subscribers. Our websites are, our shows, past shows are available on our website or also as podcasts from iTunes. Alice Schroeder is a journalist and author of The Snowball, Warren Buffett and the Business of Life. It's an incredible book, I must say. I've been telling everybody that recently. And Alice is a former research analyst who spent 5 years researching his life. Alice, hello and welcome.
Hi, how are you, Corin?
I'm good, thank you. So, and honestly, Alice, when I was reading the book, I was my first thought, it's a very thick book. And so I was like, oh my gosh, and I was kind of dreading it. And so I finally sat down with it and I started reading it, and I've just been captivated ever since. And it's you know, for somebody who I followed the business world for a long time, and I understand, you know, Warren Buffett's the, you know, the second wealthiest man in the world. And but his life story and the detail that you go into it and the honesty that you put forth in the book is incredible. So well done, Alice. I really appreciate that.
Thank you.
So what was it like writing this book and researching this?
Oh, it was, well, it was amazing because several things. One is I spent 5 years talking to Warren Buffett, and for 18 months I was out in Omaha spending most of that time being a fly on the wall sitting in his office. So nobody's ever had that experience. He's never even done so much as an interview with an author before. There have been dozens of books written either about him or at least that have his name in the title. And he's a very wise man, and he's a very interesting man. So I had this unique experience, and that was huge. But then there were many other aspects to it. I made this dramatic career change from being a numbers person to becoming an author, and I got to do a lot of other very interesting things. So it's sort of, where do you dive in?
You know, and what I've been telling people is that, I mean, the key to this show, I mean, the tagline is where inspiration and possibility meet. And what I think my journey, my personal journey, is to show people, you know, what is possible for them and success for them. And success means very different things. I mean, sometimes people may think success is only, you know, Warren Buffett stature or making the Olympic team. And, you know, I can think I'm a swim coach, and I also think that, you know, a six-year-old crossing the pool is success. So to understand that there's different levels. But one of the key things that I've done with this show is about learning that why some people are successful and why others aren't. And what I just love so much about the book was that yes, he was bright, but he worked really hard and he fell down and there were mistakes that were made. Maybe not that many, but I mean, his childhood wasn't this perfect childhood. You know, that I used to have this belief, I guess, that, oh, you know, if you grew up just in a dysfunctional household, you can't be successful. I mean, that was a crazy thought to think, but that's what I believed for so long. I thought it defined you or defined me. And so one of the things is that, I mean, even with his childhood, there was a lot of difficult realities that he grew up with. Can you tell our listeners more?
Yes. Warren grew up in a family with a very distant father who was, although that was very common in the 1940s, his father was a fairly cold, rigid person, even by the standards of the time. And his mother was emotionally abusive to an extreme degree. She would take Warren and his older sister, Doris, and scream at them literally for hours, an hour or 2 hours at a time, recounting and picking at all of their flaws and telling them that they were worthless, that they should be ashamed to be alive, they didn't deserve to exist. And Warren told me that by the time he was 3 years old, he was broken and that it could never be put back together. You can imagine the effect that would have on a child. And a lot of what has subsequently happened to him, you can trace. And there's no way to draw a perfect cause and effect. He was also a depression baby. So there was a certain amount of deprivation and being surrounded by deprivation that went along with that. But I wanted to write this book in part because, A, my own life had certain things in common with his. And so I thought it would be inspiring. I could empathize with him. And he, in public, has always had this image of not just flawlessness, but of it having been easy.
Mm-hmm.
He talks about, I tap dance to work every day, and I do this because it's fun. And he makes it look easy. And he's not lying, but it's fun, and he does enjoy what he does. And so it's given an impression that it was effortless, and it was not effortless. And to me, the story is remarkable and inspiring because you can see the struggles he went through, you can see what he overcame, and I believe that what he has accomplished is only that much more admirable because he did not start with a great hand of cards in the game of life, and he did have to struggle and overcome things.
And I think that's why I've been so compelled to just tell so many people about your book, because, you know, it dispels the myth of being the chosen one. I mean, it dispels the myth of, you know, being born with a silver spoon. I mean, he had his struggles, but it didn't stop him from the greatness that he was able to achieve.
That's right. And, you know, to the extent that people think that he's infallible and that you have to be infallible to achieve great things, this book really shows that that's not true. And also that it's not just about money. My husband, when he read it, you know, he finished the book with tears pouring down his face, and then he said, "This is a man who thought that life was all about money and learned that it's really about love."
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was, you know, really a true statement about Warren Buffett.
Well, and with the money thing, like you had mentioned earlier, that he was a Depression-era child, but even at a young age, I mean, a young age, what, 10 or 15, he believed that he could become a millionaire at 35.
Exactly. And, of course, we'll never know the earliest date that he first said it. His sisters recall it at least by age 10, maybe earlier. But he had figured out how to do the math, and he had started little businesses by the time he was 6 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So he knew that if he continued working at the pace he was working and saving money at the pace he was saving and could invest, that he would be a millionaire. And he said at various times 30 and 35, and he made it. He was a millionaire by age 30.
Yeah, and that was earlier than I think his initial goal was. And so one of the things that I do besides this show is I also do life coaching, and sometimes my clients get upset because they're trying to figure out what it is that they want to do. And one of the things that, and I've used this book as an example for my clients, is that Warren Buffett, it wasn't like he started out at 20 years old and said, "Oh, I'm going to build this holding company, Berkshire Hathaway." It was a long time before he even got to that. And it was a long journey to build. I mean, he knew that he liked numbers. He knew he liked statistics. And he was very intrigued in the investing part. But when he was young and he was kind of partnering with his dad, was that his idea that that was going to be his way of making money?
Initially, yes. You know, I think what he did, what a lot of entrepreneurs do, which is somewhat different than the corporate world, which is he started with what he had. He said, "This is what I'm good at. This is what my resources are. I'll just use them. And it'll work out." So step by step, he used his interest in investing, mm-hmm. his interest in stocks, and his willingness to work. And he put those two things together, and he just worked his tail off.
Mm-hmm.
And it came together. And the opportunity that was in front of him was to work for his father. So rather than go and try and reinvent the wheel by setting up some, you know, firm of his own or going to New York, he just did the obvious. And he just outworked everybody.
But he talks about he didn't want to be a prescriptionist.
That's right. And, of course, that's a kind of an old-fashioned word for a pharmacist,
uh-huh.
someone who is fulfilling prescriptions, or rather, I'm sorry, a doctor who is writing prescriptions.
Mm-hmm.
And what he meant by that is that stockbrokers in those days got paid on commission by the trade so that they were incentivized that if they sold you IBM one day, convince you the next week to sell it and buy AT&T instead, because they only got paid if you bought and sold. And he hated that aspect of the job, because the best thing for the client might be to buy and hold on to a stock. And in that case, he wouldn't make any money. And he was very uncomfortable with this feeling that writing tickets or writing prescriptions, as he thought, was the only way he got paid. So he got out of the business.
And I think, and that's where I think that's another great part of his journey. So, you know, there's the one part, his childhood and his family dynamics and the verbal abuse and how he didn't let that define him and feel, you know, think that he was worthless. He still was able to still see some value and able to shelter himself, cocoon himself from that. And then the next part that I saw was, you know, when he was young in college and then graduate school and in his early 20s, it was incredible how young he was. But that he tried something and he goes, "Well, I know that this is an area that I like, but this is not what I like doing with that, you know, being that
yes.
stockbroker."
Yes. So he harnessed his energy and his, you know, his tough childhood. He let that become a drive for him to become something instead of letting it defeat him. And then he took his skills and the things he was interested in, and he experimented. And when the one thing didn't work, the stockbroker, and he had some really not fun experiences. He was socially very awkward, so he would go call on clients. They would make fun of him, and they weren't very nice to him. But he decided to just try something different. And so he ended up going to New York and working as a money manager, which meant that he was not going around knocking on doors. So he just took the same set of skills and applied them in a different way.
And that's what I think is so remarkable, is that he found, you know, kind of, he eventually got to where he got to by, in some ways, a matter of deduction, you know, doing it a certain way and going, this doesn't work for me. And this is not the way. And the other thing that I loved about Warren Buffett is that he had a home-based business in the 50s.
That was so rare. Oh, Corinne, I mean, it was unthinkable to have a home-based business in the 50s. People thought he was running a Ponzi scheme like Bernie Madoff.
Uh-huh. Well, that was what was incredible, because I didn't know that part. I mean, you kind of now know, okay, Warren Buffett, he's in Omaha, Nebraska. But when you learn about his journey, I mean, he just loves Nebraska. And he is so true to who he is. But how did he get people to give him money and not think? I mean, now I would think people would be skeptical. But back then, when home-based businesses weren't even, I mean, you're supposed to be on Wall Street. That's the rules. You're supposed to be in New York.
Yes, and he was breaking all the rules. Well, he did what I think a lot of people do today, is he built a network, and he started with his family and his closest friends. And they were people that had a trust in him, and he asked them for money first. And then after, you know, a short period of time, he went to people that he'd gone to college with, his lawyer, people that he knew from business around town that he was, again, friends with, slightly more distant relatives. So he branched out one more branch in the network. And he was a great, and remains a great, networker. And I think one part of the snowball, I worked very hard to bring this into the book so people could understand his networking techniques, because he is a master networker, and it's another thing he doesn't talk about himself.
Is that why he's a great networker? Or explain more about this networking.
Well, he, and this is an interesting side benefit to his tough childhood, he learned very early not to rely on his immediate family. They weren't, he couldn't trust his family. They were, you know, cruel. And so he turned that to his advantage, in the sense that he began to seek other people that he could have relationships with. And he looked, there's a saying, you know, friends or family you create for yourself. He did that. And so he began to develop close friendships. And when he was in college, you know, he began to be very loyal. And at first it was a small number of people. He wasn't popular in high school at all. But his few close friends he treasured. And by the time that he was in his 20s, he had built a little network of people that he was very loyal to. And then over decades, that grew into something bigger. Today, you can build a network much faster because of the internet and communications, and we you know, geography, and it's easier to travel. But back then, he did it very painstakingly, and he did it by reciprocity. I will do this for you, and then you'll do something for me. He made himself useful to people. And by offering something of value, people found it to their benefit to befriend him.
This is Corinne Motokaitis, and you're listening to How She Really Does It. I'm talking with Alice Schroeder. She's the author of The Snowball, Warren Buffett, and The Business of Life. So one of the things, was that why he was, because when he, it seems like one of his rules was, especially when he was taking on his family's money in the very early onset of his career, he was very conscientious about the responsibility and not losing that money for those that he cared so much about.
That's correct. He was. You know, he had this, and this is, I think, because of his mother, a fear of being criticized, and a sense of responsibility that came from his father, who was a very moral, ethical person. And those two traits combined into a sense of rectitude and stewardship and even nobility, I think it's very honorable, because when you look today at people who are in the money management business, so many of them are just in it for the fees. And Warren Buffett always felt that if his clients, his partners, did not make money, he didn't want to earn it. He would feel disgraced if he was making money and his partners were not. And so he made promises to them that if they did not make money, he would not take fees from them.
Well, and that was his version of, because he would say, call it being on the same side of the table.
Yes.
He wanted to be on the same side of the table.
Yes, that's right. And he looks for that in relationships with people of all kinds. He found that that was a principle in life that you could apply, that when you are dealing with people, you can take note of whether they are, generally speaking, always wanting you to put up something, you know, and not reciprocating, or whether they are the kind of people who want your interest to be aligned so that everyone wins. And he tended to be somebody who's very conscious of which way people's interests were aligned.
You know, I know he's much more complicative of a man, but what I was getting from reading the book was that he was very clear on what he wanted to do, you know, and his clarity and his focus is one of the factors of his success. And then the other component is the person that he is, his integrity, right? There's some internal beliefs, being on the same side of the table, never losing money, right? There were certain things, and those, so it was the clarity of what it was that he wanted to do, and then the clarity of who he is as a person, and that focus is really what drove his success. Tell me where I'm wrong with that.
No, you're absolutely right, and one of the great lessons, you know, if I were ever to turn the snowball into sort of a how-to manual, is that, you know, having a few core principles and applying them to all aspects of your life is more effective than reading 10 zillion how-to books and listening to, you know, 10 zillion speakers, motivational speakers, and trying to learn 10 zillion different rules for specific situations. He would learn one idea, you know, he'll focus. Uh-huh. And intensity is something very important with him. And he would simply use that principle all the time. And that there were just a handful of ideas that he's used over and over in his life. And by, again, focusing like that and not trying to be scattershot, that is possibly the single greatest contributor to his success.
Well, and he would reread books over and over and over again. And
that's right. Books that were important to him, he would read 4 times, 5 times, 6 times. And Security Analysis, which was written by his teacher, Ben Graham, he's read, you know, more times than that, probably a dozen, maybe more. Because every time he would read them, he would not only find new aspects, but it would get engraved into his brain. And so that when a situation would arise during the day, some phrase or sentence from a book that was important to him would pop up and he would think to apply it.
You know, there's an author, Daniel Coyle. I've had him on my show. He wrote The Talent Code, and he talks about deep practice, and it's the practicing over and over and over again. And that's where the talent comes from, and or one of the areas. And when I take Daniel Coyle's thoughts about that in his book and I apply it to, you know, reading your book about Warren Buffett, I just see that. I mean, he just, you know, that Security Analysis was written, what, in the 30s?
Yes.
You know, and it was something that he was constantly referring to throughout his life.
That's right. And, you know, when things are timeless, they really are timeless. And, in fact, they can take on new relevancy if you let time elapse and then apply them to fresh situations later. Mm-hmm. Some of the best books in the financial crisis that we've just had were written in the Great Depression. And I've found that going back to older books has been very illuminating. So that is a great practice, taking important things and just meditating on them.
Yeah. Does he get fearful, because it you know, in the book, when there were, like, in the 70s and the market had crashed, I never got the feeling that he was afraid.
It's funny. He never seems to be ever fearful in a business situation. And he has this inner confidence about his skills in business that is unmatched. With that said, he is not self-confident when it comes to dealing with people, and he worries all the time about what people will think about him, and he's somewhat anxious about that.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe, again, that comes from being, you know, treated so horribly by his mother and being told all of his faults over and over. So in one sense, he is self-confident, but in another, not at all. And I think, again, it's admirable that he was able to surmount this insecurity to achieve what he has.
Do you think, in my previous caller, we were talking about stuff, and she had brought up this term, the rage to master. And I think I spoke about Warren Buffett, and it seems to me that, you know, with his childhood and not wanting to disappoint people and not be unliked, that might have been a bit of a rage to master, like being really good with, especially with the responsibility of managing people's money, to ignite him. So it wasn't really this fear. It was kind of the fear, but it doesn't seem like he's fearful of the market. He called it Mr. Market, but didn't want to be, he was fearful of letting people down. And that is what ignited him to really, you know, keep that focus and that clarity and that passion and be driven to be so loyal to his partners.
It's an interesting point that you make, because, yes, there is a type of personality. And, boy, we're getting into some psychological stuff here. You know, when you're a biographer, you're not supposed to psychoanalyze on the page, but it's kind of fun to do it armchair when you're on a show like this. There's a type of personality that addresses insecurity through mastery. And I do believe that he is that type. If you feel a little shaky in the world, finding a subject that you can absolutely master and become the most expert on is a way to really ground yourself. And he found that in investing, knowing more about it than anyone else on the planet was a way to have an unshakable sort of confidence mm-hmm. in that area. And it's one reason I believe that he's not really curious about art and literature, and, you know, he doesn't have a wide range of interests. You can't engage him on science and topics like that because he can't master them. You know, he focuses on what he can master. But it works. You know, it works for him. And I think it's really nice to see that, again, it's sort of self-help. He's found a way to overcome what are just terrifying insecurities by creating a world that works for him.
Yeah. I do think that, because when he was, especially when he was younger, because he grew older, and with the help of his wife and then other people in his life, he became more less rough around the edges socially. But when he was younger, he may not be able to socially interact well with people, but he always had listeners, and they would gravitate toward him when he talked about investing in money.
Exactly. When he was in high school, he couldn't get a date, but he could get a group of even teachers to gather around and listen if he would mm-hmm. talk about stocks. So that was his way of coping with the world.
And then when he did, I think it's just brilliant because, there's the cliche, when one door shuts, two windows open, right? Mm-hmm. And that was the case that happened when he decided to go get his Harvard MBA. And he was so confident about his investing knowledge, but again, he was awkward socially, very confident that it's just a done deal, he's going to go, this is just a formality. But he never got to that investing knowledge because the initial interactions weren't very good.
Harvard turned him down after a 10-minute interview. Yeah, he rode a train to Chicago, went to an interview in an extension school up there, and he was very young. He was 17, and the guy who was a, you know, an important alumni in a blazer with a Harvard crest on it, you know, took one look at him and said, "This kid does not belong at Harvard." And it ended up being the reason that he went to Columbia University and studied under Benjamin Graham, which was a much more suitable place for him. So it was meant to be. And you know, he wasn't meant to be a leader of people who was shaking hands all day long and going to meetings. And, you know, that wasn't the role that he was destined for. So he wound up in the right place.
Well, and, you know, and that's, again, I mean, I use this as an example with some clients, because sometimes it's so hard when we're going through it, right? Because he was so confident that he would go to Harvard. Didn't he have his scholarship already?
He actually had recruited one of his friends to join him at Harvard and was talking to his best friend from undergraduate school to try to get him to come. And then it was this monumental embarrassment when he got turned down. So, yes.
But that was pivotal, because he got to go and study with Ben Graham, who, I love it how he didn't even realize that this author that had meant so much to him in this book that he had written, he didn't even realize that he was actually like a human or taught at a university. There wasn't that correlation that he put. He just thought this man was brilliant and he had written this book, but he didn't. His focus, it seems to me, at least what I read in the book, his focus was so much on that information. He didn't realize that, you know, it's like when you're a kid and you don't realize that your teachers have a family or a life outside of school. You think,
oh, yeah.
It just,
and that was true. After Warren went to Columbia University, you know, Ben was this godlike person to him. You know, first of all, he was the author of the most important book that mm-hmm. Warren ever read, and then he became this teacher who was the, you know, everybody's got one teacher in their life who probably had an impact on them. I know I did. And in Warren's case, it was Ben Graham. And meanwhile, Ben Graham had this wild personal life. He had all of these women, in addition to his wife, that he was running around with. And Warren had no inkling of any of this. And Ben wrote this wild memoir where he explained his philosophy about that monogamy should not exist, and, you know, and details all these salacious aspects of his life. And Warren had no idea of any of this. He just saw this godlike, you know, creature up there who was a teacher.
Yeah, he had some perceptual blindness there.
Oh, yeah.
This is Corinne Motikaitis, and you are listening to How She Really Does It. My guest today is author and journalist Alice Schroeder, and we are talking about her book that she spent 5 years researching on Warren Buffett called The Snowball, Warren Buffett and the Business of Life. So, Alice, you brought this up, and I don't know if you want to go there or not, but when you talk about Ben Graham and his outside interests, what was Warren Buffett's relationship with Kay Graham?
Oh, you know, I don't mind going there.
Okay.
I'll go anywhere you like.
Okay.
It's fine. I wrote the book. You know, Catherine Graham was publisher of the Washington Post, and she's one of the most important women that I think is a role model for other women to understand. Anybody who's not familiar with her should read Personal History, her memoir. She was the woman who decided to publish the Pentagon Papers, and she made that decision in the face of opposition, and she was proclaimed by Fortune magazine the most courageous chief executive officer of a company in American history. She was an amazing woman, and Warren met her in 1973 in connection with buying the stock of the Washington Post. And Catherine Graham had a terrible, terrible life. Her mother had treated her much the way Warren's mother had treated him. Kay had married a man who was not only verbally and physically abusive, but also bipolar, and there was something else wrong with him that was never identified, but he was just, he was hospitalized and then came home and committed suicide in their house while Kay was there. So she had had a number of things happen to her that had made her quite a fragile person. When she and Warren met each other, they instantly had this rapport, and they began spending a lot of time together. Warren became her teacher about business. She introduced him to the world of Washington society, and she took the Tasty from Nebraska and she dressed him properly and she taught him how to interact among people in Washington and the diplomatic circles. But of course, Warren was married, and Kay and Warren had a relationship that was, you know, went beyond a friendship. And one of the things I wrote in the book, it was a little ambiguous, and the reason it was ambiguous is that while they clearly were more than friends, you know, I don't think it was very long-lived, and I'm not sure how successful a relationship it really was. And the truth is, they were friends for decades. They were really friends, and if, to the extent there was a sexual relationship, it wasn't the main thing going on there. It was a side issue, but it was enough. His obsession and infatuation with Kay was enough that it really shunted Susie, his wife, Susie Buffett, aside. And the two of them, I don't know if you want me to keep going
yes,
with the story,
yes.
But Warren and Susie had been living somewhat separate lives by then for a while because they were a classic 1950s couple that she raised the kids, he was focused on work, and all her energies had been put into the family, and she wanted more, and she was not getting what she wanted out of the marriage. He was not very attentive to her. The focus on work that we talked about earlier, which was so wonderful in terms of his passion for business, was not really very wonderful for his family. And so by the early 1970s, you know, Susie had sort of developed a life of her own, and they were on parallel tracks. And then when Katharine Graham came along, it became very publicly known that they were sort of living separate lives. And at that point, Susie Buffett decided that, you know, she really couldn't deal with the situation any longer. And so she moved to San Francisco, and she and Warren separated, but they never divorced to the end of her life. They stayed married, and they were emotionally still very tied together.
And she would show up and be his wife at events.
Absolutely. They traveled together for several weeks a year for vacations. They spent every Christmas together. He talked to her on the phone nearly every day. And I witnessed many of these phone calls, and they were ooey, gooey, lovey-dovey. He worshipped her.
Mm-hmm.
It was as real a relationship as you can imagine, and yet they didn't see each other in person that often. It was a very interesting situation.
And now, because in the beginning, when they first recording, she was in love with a gentleman who was Jewish, and that was not acceptable with her family at the time. And she really wasn't interested in Warren, but he really made this determination that he was going to get her, and he got her, and they were family friends. Their parents were friends, and she married him. And it sounded to me that she grew to love him. That wasn't her true love, but she grew to love him, and she saw this really hurt man, and she really helped. I mean, she really helped him in so many ways.
That's a perfect description. Susie was a woman who was a compulsively giving person. She just loved people, loved the world, and when she saw someone who was broken or in need, she just gravitated toward that person and was so generous with herself and with giving. And she was genuinely in love with Milton Brown. Her father was determined to pry her apart from Milton because he was Jewish and he was a first, you know, generation American-born son of an immigrant family. And there was a great deal of prejudice against Jews in those days. And so Susie ended up marrying Warren. Clearly, the attraction with Warren was that he needed her so much. But if you look at the photograph from their wedding, which I have in the book, they look really happy that day.
Mm-hmm.
It looks very sincere.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there was anything about it that she was being dragged to the altar.
No.
By any means.
No, and they were, you know, especially in the beginning, you described them being very physical and very lovey-dovey, and he was even later on, he would always be, you know, out in public about, you know, just gushing about how wonderful she was, but at home it would be empty.
Yes, you know, Warren is a funny person, and so he'd be happy with someone's presence, and he would be in the house and he'd be upstairs in his office working. And the fact that Susie was simply present was enough for him. You know, I mean, I've seen other people like this, perhaps not that extreme, but he took for granted that she knew how much he loved her and depended on her. It would never have occurred to him to leave her. And so it never dawned on him that she might leave him.
But then why have this? And I understand the excitement about with the Kay Graham, and she was a very smart woman, and I'm sure that led to the attraction. But then why stray outside the marriage if he loved her so much?
You know, there's an old saying that at most there are two people who understand what's going on inside any marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say with humility that I cannot fully explain and wouldn't presume to understand everything about this marriage. But certainly, Warren has a long-standing habit of getting fascinated by people.
Mm-hmm.
And not just women, but just he meets a new person, and it's just like a switch turns on.
Charlie
and
Munger.
His new BFF.
Yeah, like Charlie Munger.
Like, yes. And most of these people don't last, but every now and then one does. And he can't really help it. I really believe that he just assumed that he took Susie for granted to such a degree that he assumed that he could do no wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen him behave. I know him very, very well.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very well. Not in the sense that you're someone might be thinking, but I after spending 5 years observing somebody at such close distance, what I have seen is that in his mind, if people love him and care about him, then he just takes for granted that whatever he does will be okay with them.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever he does.
And you know, these questions are coming. I mean, obviously, we've had Tiger Woods episode that's come out. And it's not to be voyeuristic. I think sometimes people are just trying to understand, mm-hmm. right? Because I remember, I mean, I'm 37. So I remember, like, I always just thought, okay, he's this Midwestern, wholesome values, gentleman who's very wealthy up in Nebraska. And then I remember coming out where his wife had left him. And it was just news just recently. But apparently it's been longer than that. Or it was when it finally came on my, spectrum. And I thought, what? And he has a mistress? What? But you go into the story. I mean, there's so much more to it than that. And then the fact that they were married and he didn't remarry until a couple of years after Susie's death. And even prior to that, they went, like you said, they traveled together. They showed up at events together. They had two homes, two separate lives. But then they were very much together. And so they were able to, it sounds like, to really figure out on their terms what worked for them.
Yes, it was absolutely real, and yet it was an unusual relationship that most people wouldn't choose.
Mm-hmm.
Warren is not really capable of taking care of himself.
Mm-hmm.
He actually, one of my favorite stories is one time he was home alone, and he called somebody to ask how to turn on the oven. And he really is, I have seen a degree of helplessness in this man that really is hard to describe. When Susie left, she knew that he could not live without a woman. And so she arranged for one of her friends
uh-huh.
to go and initially, quote unquote, take care of Warren. But they, of course, it turned into a relationship. And they lived together for nearly 30 years before Susie died. And then he married her 2 years later. Her name is Astrid Minx, and she's a lovely person. And they made this triangular situation work out. It was very unusual and very unconventional. But the key is they were open about it.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't hiding anything. And so there wasn't any hypocrisy involved. There were people who disapproved of it, but they weren't hiding anything.
Well, and I think that's different than the Tiger Woods situation where, things are blowing up. And, this, the fact that Susie basically set Warren up, because that was a question that somebody, a listener, had asked me earlier in the week. And I said, no, Susie found this woman who came and who eventually became his wife.
Right.
So, it's a very different. And then the fact that he's in the Midwest and doing this is just mind-boggling. But then it really, when I think about of what I've read from in your book of who he is and living his truth, it works, if that makes sense. You know, the fact that he's going to run a home-based business in the 50s dealing with money out of Omaha, Nebraska. The fact that he's not going to, you know, he wouldn't let people know what he was investing in. Like, if you joined his partnerships, here were the principles laid out, including his payment, but he wasn't going to let you know what he was investing in. He was very upfront with that. It wasn't hidden. Like, he had his terms laid out. It was all open.
You've just touched on one of the really important things in two aspects. One is to be open. And also, and this is part of one of his real secrets of success, is you'll see over and over in reading the book that when there's a problem, Warren deals with it and then he moves on. He doesn't let it become an endlessly complicating factor in his life.
Mm-hmm.
And if you contrast it with the Tiger Woods situation, or really anybody who's had a problem in their marriage, you know, people have problems and then maybe they have an affair, and you get these outcomes where, you know, the situation comes out, it gets resolved, and then something happens one way or the other, and they either move on or not. But you have a problem where somebody's got 10 mistresses and their wife doesn't know.
Yes.
And they're living this double life for mm-hmm. who knows how long. And when you've got that complexity, you know, and you've got a problem, but you're not dealing with it. And the thing that's so great about Warren Buffett is that, you know, he deals with anything that comes up, he just deals with it.
Mm-hmm.
And he has a clarity, which you mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, nobody's life is perfect. Nobody, I think, would want their life to be examined with a microscope from one end or the other. But what's been great about him is that he's grown, and when he has made mistakes or had transgressions, he has dealt with them, and then increasingly throughout his life, he hasn't repeated the same mistakes. He's moved to a higher level.
I just got chills when you said that. And I think that's the key, is to grow and to learn and to move forward, right?
Right.
I mean, we see a lot of people who are successful, who are out, have public personas out there, and it's like, okay, how many more times do we have to see this? You're going into rehab, or you're, you know, this, or you're a sex addict, or you're having another affair. You just get kind of, it's the same story. But with him, it's, he grows and he learns. And like you said, like your husband had stated, was that he realized that love was more important than money after his lifetime of going through this.
That's right. That's right. So maybe next time Tiger Woods will have only 9. So I'm just kidding. I have a feeling he's had a big learning experience here.
I would hope so. The lesson had to be really big for him to learn, because I don't think he was learning when he was getting a little taps on the head. I'm wrapping up our discussion with Alice Schroeder, author of The Snowball, Warren Buffett and the Business of Life. You're listening to Karen Motokaitis on How She Really Does It. So one other factor that I do want to go back, not to dredge this all up, but how did his, because his focus was so intense on his business and on his work and his loyalty. I mean, this was some of the sufferings with Susie, was he was so loyal to his partnerships and so infatuated with the people that he was working with. I mean, that's where some of the neglect came with Susie and also his children. So how is his relationship with them, and with, I guess, partly with their relationship with his relationship with their mother, and then with also them as they've gone on?
That's been nice to see, because when he was younger and totally focused on work, Susie's warmth and her people orientation became the emotional conduit for the family. So that, excuse me, in effect, she was the channel for everything. And he delegated that to her, and he abdicated a bit on his emotional responsibilities. After Susie died in 2004, she died of a stroke after a bout with oral cancer, he took some steps to become closer to his children. And he had been, over the years, becoming a little more generous to them with money, which was something that was helpful. But after Susie died, you know, he began to develop the heart connection with them that had always been missing. And while you can't change the past, so he couldn't, you know, give back the childhood that they didn't have playing baseball with him or whatever, at the same time, You know, I think children who've had a somewhat estranged relationship with a parent early in life are extremely grateful when later in life they're able to have that time with the parent that, you know, before it's too late.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's happened here, is they're much closer than they were.
And that's another really good lesson for people to hear and to learn, is that you, because maybe, you know, we may have regrets in our life, but that doesn't have to define the continuing relationship, that we can go forth with what we have today and what we have to offer.
That's right. That's exactly true. I think it requires the goodwill of all the parties. But one of the nice, inspiring things about this is that, you know, everybody involved has said, you know, let's just forget the past, and what we care about is the here and now.
Alice, thank you so much for being a guest today on my show. This has just been incredible, and thank you for writing the book.
Oh, thank you, Corinne.
This is Corinne Motokaitis, and thanks for listening to How She Really Does It. We've had Alice Schroeder, author of The Snowball, Warren Buffett, and The Business of Life.